right, so welcome to the AgriCurious podcast, and I'm your host, Dennis Bafo-Iwa. You can call me the Artistic Scientist. Across the eastern United States, apples and peaches are more than just fruits. So they're a way of life. From New York's Hudson Valley to Georgia's Peach Belt, thousands of growers supply local markets and global distributors alike. But in recent years, they've been hit by unpredictable weather, invasive pests, and new regulatory limits on long-use insecticides. These challenges have made traditional integrated pest management somehow a little less reliable. Well, that's where we bring in Cultivating Tomorrow's Orchard, which is a USDA-funded multi-state project known as the Eastern Tree Fruit. Now, the goal is to re-engineer pest management for apples and peaches across state and state using risk-based decision-making tools, biological controls, and grower-driven innovations to make orchards more resilient and sustainable. Now, my guests today are two key scientists on the front line of this effort. I do have Dr. Brett Blau, who is an associate professor and extension specialist with the University of Georgia and Clemson University, who focuses on peach IPM in the Southeast, and Dr. Monique Rivera, assistant professor of entomology at Cornell Agritech and faculty fellow at the Atkinson Center for Sustainability, and is also involved in apple IPM work in the Northeast. Together, they're on this project doing quite some wonderful job, and we have them here to discuss their work, what they face, and also the room for collaboration between these two sides on the project and what all this project is about. So be my guest as I get to talk to them. Dr. Blau, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, Dr. Blau, could you please tell us about your work personally with the University of Georgia and Clemson University?
Yes. So I have a unique position where I have a dual appointment with both UGA and Clemson University working with peach entomology, which is actually really exciting because I get to work with both growers in the state of Georgia as well in the state of South Carolina. And while we have a lot of similar issues in both states, each state has their own unique set of problems dealing with insect management. And so I get to do research trying to identify these issues and then try to incorporate some new management tactics in order to help these growers manage their peaches to the best of their ability.
Now, how has it been like working with two universities? How do you find it?
It's been actually really nice because I get to work with both the researchers at both universities. So we have a peach team at the University of Georgia as well as at Clemson who are plant pathologists, horticulturalists. There's peach breeders. So as we get to work with both sides, and I feel like I'm kind of a bridge between the two states. And so that not only are we all trying to help the peach industry in each individual state, but we're trying to help the peach industry across the Southeast. And I'm not saying that I'm the best bridge, but I am kind of a bridge between the two states. And so I'm able to utilize the resources that both Georgia has and South Carolina has in order to help these research projects come to life.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Now, let's talk about the Eastern tree fruit industry itself. What makes this region unique? I mean, talking about environmentally, economically, or even culturally.
Yeah. So environmentally is probably the biggest difference when we compare ourselves to the West Coast. California is the largest producer of peaches in the country, and they're really producing these peaches in a desert-like environment. So there's very little humidity, very little rain, which allows them to also have very little issues with diseases and in with some cases, some of our pest insects. And so that makes growing and managing peaches in the western side of the U.S. a lot easier. Whereas in the East Coast, we have high humidity, high pest pressure, and we're dealing with just a lot of issues. And so that makes it a unique area to grow, but also a very unique area for pest management.
Okay. So let's move to the whole pest pressures. What are some of those unique things that you have found with regards to, you know, the tree fruits and in pests?
Yeah, so with the tree fruit pests, especially in peaches in the Southeast, we have one key pest that's unique for us, which is the plum curculio. So out west, basically west of the Rocky Mountains, they do not have plum curculio. And plum curculio is just this tiny little weevil that lays its eggs in the fruit, and then the eggs hatch and the larvae feed on the fruit from the inside, which makes the fruit pretty gross, pretty unmarketable. So that becomes a pretty big issue for us in terms of our management. We also have plum curculio up in the Northeast. So New York and even Michigan also have issues with plum curculio, but up there they only have one generation a year. So they have a huge battle early season, but in the Southeast they has 2 to 3 generations every year. And so it's a continual battle every year for us.
Okay. And how does this plum curculio impact peaches? Do they just make them not so marketable, or they actually also somehow not making it edible or safe for consumption?
Right. So actually, if you ate a plum curculio, it'd be perfectly fine. It's just a little larvae, maybe a little bit of extra protein, a little extra crunch in your fruit. However, most people do not want to bite into a fruit and find a larvae or a quote unquote worm in their fruit. And so unfortunately, when people find those worms in their fruit, it can turn them off from that type of fruit for a very long time. So from a marketing perspective, if a grower produces a fruit that has a worm in it, they might lose a big part of their market just because people get grossed out and they won't want to buy that fruit again. And so it's perfectly harmless, but it's just kind of gross enough that it could really change the way people think about buying and eating fruit.
Okay, thank you. All right, so Dr. Rivera, can you tell us about your work as well? And how has it been like being an entomologist and dealing with apples in the East?
So true story, I had never actually really set foot in an apple orchard until I took this job. So before taking this job here at Cornell, I was previously at UC Riverside. And before I left California, I had some colleagues and we went up to Washington and they were showing me a little bit of the apple industry up there. So that was really the first time that I saw or witnessed an apple orchard in my current role. You know, I never scouted apples before. And I think for me, the thing that was the most shocking was the horticulture behind it all. It's intensely managed horticulture almost more than anything else. And I think that creates a really dynamic research environment that does help solve some of our problems as entomologists. For example, one of the things that apple growers are doing is growing fruit on dwarfing rootstocks, making the trees smaller. So they're able to grow up to, you know, 1,200, sometimes even it can be in specific production systems, 1,500 trees per acre. And what this does in terms of entomology that I think helps us as entomologists with pest management is this creation of the fruiting wall. So spray coverage when it comes to a full-size tree is quite complicated. It's really hard to penetrate the canopy and know that you have effective coverage without using a ton of water. So with the fruiting wall, growers are able to manage their pests and diseases, I think, with a lot more precision in apple. And I think that is overall a benefit of the system, but I don't think it makes any of the problems less complicated. We're still up against a suite of insect pests that is persistent year over year, that vary in accordance with different temperature conditions and different even tree stress can affect how our pest dynamic progresses over the course of the season. So I think especially coming from citrus, which is in particular very low input comparatively tree fruit crop, the amount of input into apples to me is always very impressive. And that's only speaking from the insect side. It's not the main driver of the overall IPM program. It's most likely, and I think everyone would agree with this, that it's pathology on the East Coast. So your fungal and bacterial diseases. So those are the things that have really stood out for me, my perception as someone entering the system with no experience.
Okay. And I hope you have enjoyed your experience so far. All right. So let's talk about pests in your area. What is the most destructive pest with your work?
So for me, I think that varies year over year, what is causing the most destruction. And this year was a really weak year for internal lepidopterans, or moths that have internally feeding larvae or caterpillars. But this year, again, it changes from the beginning of the season to the end. We had a very weird spring. And so by the end of the season, one of the biggest concerns was woolly apple aphid, where in the beginning of the season, it was so slow to warm up that we really weren't seeing the populations we were expecting to see. This year, we also, in certain parts of the state, had really extended spring weather that caused Plum Curculio to be pretty damaging. So I'm sure Brett's already talked about Plum Curculio. That's a persistent one year over year. But typically with our insecticide tools, is decently well managed if the applications are timed correctly.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Now, Dr. Blau, I'm going to get to you. So for the benefit of our listeners, even though I had talked about it briefly in the introduction, can you explain to us what this Eastern Tree Fruit project is all about?
Yeah. So this project is really designed to bring together really about 14 researchers from different universities and USDA across the East Coast, really to try to figure out a better way that we can identify and implement integrated pest management tools into our pest management strategies. But not only to be able to integrate those strategies, but also to make sure that they are economical and effective for the growers. And so we have an economist as well as a sociologist to help us identify how expensive these tools are going to cost and what kind of barriers there exist for growers in order to adopt them. And so it's really, we have this research to identify the best management tactics, as well as to identify how we can best get those incorporated into what the growers are already doing, so that we have an industry that's not only economical, but hopefully also sustainable.
Okay. Dr. Rivera, let me ask you. So this project I know combines entomology, horticulture, economics, and social science. How do you think this multidisciplinary setup strengthens your outcome with the project?
So anytime you have a federally funded project where we're using taxpayer funds in order to create more information and also help growers refine their growing programs, you can call them IPM programs, it's really beneficial to have a lot of sets of expertise looking at these problems to make sure that, in particular, from the research perspective, that we're doing research that is beneficial. So I think a lot of times with interdisciplinary work, one of the benefits of the outcome is that you are quicker to be able to apply the information because it requires a lot more interaction with people inside and outside of that specific field. So for example, with the sociology component, it's really good to have the growers involved in this way because it gives us a top-down view of what are we researching and how could it be applied and how interested are growers in applying this. And then the feasibility of that comes from the economists. So I think in any case where you're trying to be a good steward of funds, this interdisciplinary work is super beneficial because what we're ultimately looking for are outcomes. And I think this helps to benefit having strong outcomes from a project.
Okay. So how far are we in this project?
I would say we're really early.
Okay.
We've really just scraped the surface here of getting some things out into the field. I actually would argue that probably the sociologists are the furthest along in terms of objectives. They've done a lot of work pre-screening the growers to figure out their interests and to start building relationships where they can have interviews that can give us more information and feedback on some of the research we're doing.
Okay. So are growers an integral part of this particular project?
We would like to believe so, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So, Brett, let me come to you. You talked about the most destructive pest in your area of work, but let's also talk about your production challenge with regards to peach. So when it comes to peach growers in the Southeast right now, what is that biggest production challenge that they face that you know about?
That's a really good question, because our key problem right now is climate. And that's something we are sort of getting at in this project in terms of looking at how climate impacts the phenology, or basically the development of insects and when they're active. But that's not really what the growers are really concerned with. They're having more concern horticulturally with issues with spring frost killing our flowers and our buds, so that we don't really have a yield when it comes to harvest. And so horticulturally, the biggest issue is going to be our climate. However, when it comes down to actual pest management, their biggest issue is really the scale of their production. In both Georgia and South Carolina, we have very large producers, which is great. So we produce a lot of fruit. However, that makes it challenging to actually use some of our integrated pest management tactics on that large scale, because they are trying to manage thousands of acres when a phenology model is telling you, oh, we need to manage this pest on this certain time frame. Well, they might not be able to actually get that time frame down in time to actually do an effective management strategy. So really, the scale of the production is very difficult here in terms of trying to incorporate some of these tactics into their management programs.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Rivera, what about you? The biggest production challenge?
I think that really changes year over year in commercial apple in New York, and it also probably shifts by region. But I think the thing on the top of every grower's mind is the actual market in which they're selling into. It's a weak apple price right now, and how they're marketing their fruit is everything to how much money they are actually going to receive. So I'm not saying pest management is the least of their concerns. It's more one of many, and one that is more subtractive to their bottom line. So it's something that costs rather than is something that is going to earn them more. So I would rank us maybe like fourth or fifth in the list of concerns with price of apples, labor, pathology, and weather issues leading above pest management when it comes to insects.
Okay. So, I mean, I would want to find out from the both of you, growers' perception of IPM and your regions, how do they differ? Dr. River, I want to hear from you first, and then I'll move to Dr. Blau.
Oh, okay. I was going to go in alphabetical order and make sure I go first. When it comes to IPM, so I think one of the things to recognize about, in particular, what I feel is unique to the New York, probably across agriculture, is a lot of our New York growers are educated at Cornell. And they take a lot of coursework that aligns with a lot of these ideas. So their exposure and their interest is quite high, I think, compared to some of the other commodities I've worked in. And what's really something that's great about this is that these are also family farms. Typically, you would see this level of interest and education in a more commercial operation that, you know, for example, in California, big business ag, where they're investing a lot of money into also their own research and development. So it's really nice to see that here in New York. I think the growers are interested, but like all people running a business, they are interested in making sure that this is actually beneficial to their bottom line and keeping their business sustainable in terms of their finances, as well as taking care of the environment.
Okay. Dr. Blau, your take?
Yeah, exactly. I would have to agree with Monique. Our growers here, they are 100% believe in IPM. They like the strategies. They love the concept behind it. But it really comes down to feasibility and economics. And so we can prove that something might work really well, but if it's not economical for them on their bottom line, they're not going to adopt it. And so it's really, it can be frustrating from a research standpoint, but from a business standpoint, it's totally understandable that this is their livelihoods, and growers need to make money for things to work. And so we need to have these strategies that are both effective and economical. And so from the growers I work with, I have a wide range of very large, so like 3,000 acres of peaches, to very small, just to, you know, I work with homeowners, but also people that might be managing 20 to 50 acres of peaches. And some of those smaller scale growers, it is easier for them to adopt some of these strategies because they only have to go out and manage 50 acres of peaches, which is still a lot, but it's a lot easier than managing 3,000. And so some of the scale of the operation can make it easier for these growers to adopt. So even though there's still the bottom line is whether or not it makes them money, it's easier to adopt these on a smaller scale. So a lot of my smaller scale growers tend to use more IPM strategies than our larger ones.
Okay, great. All right, so you're still listening to the AgriCurious podcast. And like I told you, I'm with two scientists who are part of the Eastern Tree Fruit Project, Dr. Brett Blau from UGA and Clemson University, and Dr. Monique Rivera from Cornell AgriTech. And they're joining me today to talk about peaches and apples and also integrated pest management. So in this project, I just want to know, is knowledge or the findings transferable from one side to the other. I'm talking about peaches and apples. Are they so much alike that we can transfer the knowledge or the insights we receive from one to the other, or they are very distinct?
I don't know anything about peaches, but I feel like Brett knows stuff about peaches and apples. So I'm going to let Brett answer this one.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So a lot of it's going to be situational. So it might turn out that a lot of the information we find are going to be transferable. But sometimes it's going to be or potentially not transferable. So that's one thing we're still trying to work out. Because in part, like we're talking about Plum Curculio in the Northeast, Plum Curculio has one generation per year. And down here, it can be up to three generations per year. And so if we're looking at early season strategies for management, that probably will be transferable between apples and peaches. Because understanding when these insects are active and ways to help manage them in this early season is probably going to be very similar between apples and peaches. However, if we're looking at late season management tactics, that's probably only going to be a Southeastern thing, or maybe even Southern New Jersey and West Virginia also have the same strain as we do in Georgia. So some things will be transferable, but when we're looking at things, well, one, for instance, is dogwood borer. That's an issue that only apples will have. We do not have that issue in peaches. And so there are specific pests that we won't really see transfer between the crops. But some things, when it comes down to like phenology models, which again is looking at how insects develop based on timing and temperatures. And so we can look at that, and that should be transferable, assuming that temperature accumulation is going to be similar across the sites and across the different crops. So it's, I think it's very situational, but I'm hoping that things that we come up with are, if not transferable, at least the ideas will help us develop new tactics across the different sites.
Okay, great. So my next question will also be the role of extension and communication and making sure growers actually understand and adapt new methods or whatever insights that you will gather. How or what is the role of extension and communication? How is it rooted in this particular project?
Okay, so I think because we have a stakeholder advisory board and we're directly interacting with the growers through the survey work, I think that that's one way or one avenue with which we will translate information. I can see there being slides developed just on grower responsiveness and shared across this Northeast region. But additionally, when it comes to some of the more, I would say they're applied questions, but they are almost sort of existential as they cross state lines. For example, we put out a project this year looking at comparing codling moth lures. There's a lot of options in the market, but being able to see from, let's say, you know, 30,000 feet up, the whole northeastern seaboard, trying to figure out which of these works most effectively. I think that's one of the big values of this project, is it lends us a lot more confidence to questions like that in being able to recommend, hey, this one works the best, and it works the best in all along the eastern seaboard, so that all of us can unite together in that messaging. So I think that's really the benefit of us working together and seeing this from a regional focus. And I think where extension will in turn then provide these results back to growers with, I think, increased confidence because we've seen the results across state lines.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Blau, so this is a very interesting question that I'm asking you, and it has to do with technology. So in your line of work, are there some things like smart traps or maybe even AI-based models that could actually be a game changer for orchard IPM?
Yes. Unfortunately, this is something that I have not really worked with much. I know Monique's worked with smart traps. I have not. Some of the key pests that we have in Georgia, we just don't have the technology yet to test those. But with apple pests, especially like codling moth and oriental fruit moth, these smart traps can be a very, very effective tool. I'm hoping that that kind of technology continues to grow, because I would love to incorporate it and test it in the Southeast.
Okay. Dr. Rivera, would you want to talk about these smart traps and this technology that you are used to?
So let's first maybe give a background or an overview of what is the real benefit of these smart traps. And so we've been using them for about, I might even be 3 years now. And what we see, I mean, again, these can make our lives as researchers also more convenient. Checking traps is not always so fun for us either. But I think the main benefit is that the idea of a biofix when it comes to the models is typically the first capture of a pest in the season. And so being able to pinpoint that using a smart trap that is taking photos every hour versus a trap being checked once a week could potentially bring us more precision in the pest management in terms of understanding our timing using the models. And so that's what I think from a research perspective is interesting about the use of these tools. When it comes to AI and machine learning, there's tons of tools being developed. It's not just the smart traps. Working with Dr. Emily Bick at University of Wisconsin on the insect eavesdropper. This is a microphone that you can clip to a plant. And we're hoping to be able to use machine learning to train the models to recognize what pest is making what noise. And so that's just another example of ways in which the implementation of these sort of computer science skills is going to potentially elevate IPM.
So do you see the future of IPM integrating more of these technologies in the future?
Yes, and they already do in some places. So one thing in the West Coast is there's a brand called Simios that has a pretty big stronghold in the Apple industry out there. And it's a fully integrated service-based model, meaning that you pay a monthly fee, but they are utilizing those camera traps and their models, but they're also having all kinds of other sensors in the farm and being able to give direct feedback to growers out there. This has not taken off on the East Coast. I think part of that is that there's not a lot of demonstration of this here. And I think our system is so much more complex because of the environment. The humidity and our pest pressure is very much so higher because of the landscape dynamics on the East Coast. It's just very integrated with forested areas and also suburban areas. And it's not just thousands of acres blocks of farmland. So I do see that this will eventually become a tool that's commonly used. I think that one of the strongest avenues and quickest avenues to using AI, in my opinion, in agriculture would be taking something like Agrion, which is basically a repository of labels associated with pesticides, and being able to turn that into a chatbot. Like a large language model where you can actually ask the large language model, tell it what state you're in and be able to peruse those labels more effectively and have the AI actually spit out some recommendations. Now, will this in some way step on our toes in terms of what we do? You could think of it like that, but you could also think of it as an accessory with which you could garner ideas for comparison, right? So if the AI model is recommending this, we can actually try that in the field and further refine those recommendations. So I don't like to think of these things as in contest. I really think that in the end, all of these things will work together and it's not going to replace people going into the field and doing field work, at least not for the foreseeable future. I don't really think so in me and Brett's lifetime that we're going to have a full robot workforce where we can do ag research with robots. I mean, never say never, but I just really have my doubts.
All right. And you already answered my next question with that. So thank you for answering it even before I asked. Now, Dr. Blow, let me ask you, what will success look like at the end of this project?
Yeah, so success is going to be, it's another kind of situational because we have four different objectives in this proposal, and each one will have varying levels of success depending on how it ends up. However, if we look at the overarching goal is to really increase the resiliency of eastern tree fruit production. And success for that would be developing tactics to either help monitor and or improve management of some of our key pests. So we're targeting specific pests across the East Coast that are already considered relatively difficult to manage. And so if we can help growers improve the management efficacy or at least reduce the cost of managing these insects, and then also actually incorporating some of these tactics into their current management programs, I would consider that a success. But we could also even just look at increasing grower knowledge of these different pests. And so across the board, even though a lot of these insects are very similar, or if not found in all states, attacking both apples and peaches, there is a different level of knowledge across our grower cooperation. And so if we can get them all to be on the same page to understand what it takes to manage these insects, increase their understanding of their biology, and then maybe an overlap there so that we can improve management, I'll consider that a success as well.
Okay. Thank you so much. Now, Dr. Rivera, how might this project change the way we think about pest management nationally? How will it influence that?
I struggle to think of the connection nationally just because the growing environments on the West Coast and the East Coast are so different. But along the Eastern Seaboard, I think what we're doing here is refining recommendations to what we're hoping to do is lower input costs via creating more effective ways to manage pests. The other thing we're doing is hedging our bets in a way, because one of the biggest challenges, and I will call this threat for sure existential, is the limitation that continues to occur on tools in the current toolbox. And so anytime you're developing a tool that doesn't require insecticides or aims to reduce their use, I think this is, in a way, hedging one's bets against future pending restrictions on tools that we currently use.
Okay, thank you. So my last but one question to this will be to the both of you. What are your personal motivations? What drives you to do this kind of work? I mean, with growers, with pests, with the research that you're doing, what motivates you to be a part of this? And I'll start with you, Dr. Blau.
Yeah, my motivation comes a lot from, well, one, my interest in entomology. I'm a bug nerd. I love working in agriculture and just looking at insects. Now that I've worked in this industry for almost 10 years, I also have a really personal connection. I know a lot of the growers personally. I love working with them. It's been a fantastic group of people. And so I just really want to help them manage their fruits because it's just like, I feel like I'm part of the team now. And so if they succeed, I succeed. And if I succeed, hopefully they'll succeed. And so I really have that personal connection and motivation for working in here. I also have more of a selfish, just because it is my job. I want to succeed at my job as well. And part of my job is doing this research. And so increasing our knowledge of insects and how to manage them is going to hopefully help me through my job as well.
Right.
But the real motivation is to help our industry, help it across the East Coast, and just really improve the resilience of producing tree fruit in the United States.
Okay, thank you very much. And Dr. Rivera, the same for you, your motivation and also what excites you most about this project?
Ooh, that's a heavy hitting question, you know? So let's start with maybe my personal motivation. So one of the things that I absolutely love is American agriculture. I love the idea of us being a food secure country that can produce all of its own food and not have to import. I think of this in maybe a little bit of a nationalistic way, in that I really would like to protect these environments, these relationships that people have built oftentimes over multiple familial generations. I think this is, for me, just maybe one of my core values as an American. And then secondarily, from a more nerdy point of view, I mean, I could pretty much just copy paste Brett's answer. You know, I'm an entomologist. I got into entomology thinking bugs were cool. My first internship was with the state of Delaware's IPM specialist. And it was on that first day of that job that I really knew what I wanted to do. And the thing that excites me the most was seeing how Extension has this ability to communicate with the stakeholders and to affect change. I think that just being able to have the opportunity to communicate science and do it in a way where you're connecting with people, for me, is what I find really lights my fire in this job. Because as much as I like science, I like to keep that word to a like, because science is this ever-evolving sort of amorphous thing. And there's good days and there's bad days. And so if you love it, it's going to hurt a lot. So liking it keeps a nice distance from it and says, you know what, we're going along as we're going along. We're figuring it out one thing at a time. And hopefully, you know, the end goal here is to communicate back these results, both to our local stakeholders, our nationally, our group of stakeholders, but then also to the scientific community, so that we can also share our results on an international scale to help other countries also potentially benefit from some of the work that we're doing through applying some of our ideas. So that's my small soapbox about that.
All right, so thank you all so much for joining me on this episode of the AgriCurious podcast, throwing insight onto this project, the Eastern Tree Fruit Project. And it's been a beautiful conversation, and many thanks to you. So I had here Dr. Brett Blau from the University of Georgia and also Clemson University, and Dr. Monique Rivera from Cornell University, and both are entomologists that deal with pests. We have learned about, you know, the diversity of their work, one dealing with peaches, one dealing with apples, and they have spoken to us about this particular project, and I'm pretty sure we still have them to measure some progress of the work as we go on, and it's been a beautiful one. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode, and I hope to talk to you again soon in the course of this project.
Well, thanks so much, Dennis.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you.